State lawmakers spent the morning debating the settlement to the ongoing education funding lawsuit. Supporters say concerns about timing are unnecessary.
We need to get significant dollars into the classroom, and whether or not that is immediate or whether or not that will happen in 6 to 9 months, I'll take the money in 6 to 9 months if that's the case.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, the Clean Elections Commission is set to vote on a new rule on dark money. We meet the new president of the Navajo Nation.
Peoria residents get their say on their city's charter.
And are comic strips a lost art?
In a world of 7 second attention spans, a newspaper comic is a 4 second read.
Plus, we hit the midway and remembering one of the last cowboy legislators.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, one accident to watch out for. It's I-10 westbound at 7th Street, but it also may be affecting eastbound traffic as well. Meanwhile, Valley weather, it'll stay partly cloudy for the rest of today. There is a 40% chance for some rain. There has been rain reported in parts of the valley. So far here at KJZZ, though, we've just seen cloudy skies. And then for tomorrow, partly sunny, a 20% chance for rain, a high of 79. Sunny skies Saturday with a high of 80. Currently, it's cloudy and 81 degrees.
Over the next couple of years, the Grand Canal, which cuts through central Phoenix, will be transformed into a multi-use pathway with lighting, improved neighborhood access points, landscaping, and public art. And that's just phase one of what the city is calling the Grand Canalscape Project. Yesterday, Phoenix officials announced they won a $10 million grant for phase two. KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports.
Ground hasn't even been broken on phase one yet. That's supposed to happen next summer. But the city is already looking ahead. Phase two will see the creation of a pathway from the I-17 to Tempe Town Lake. Kerry Wilcoxon is with the city of Phoenix. He says eventually, the western flank of the Grand Canal will also undergo a similar transformation. In fact, when it comes to all of the canals,
20, 30,000 trips per day on a canal bank would be something to aspire to. Because I think once you do that, not only do you change the psyche of the city, you start realizing the possibilities of a foot-based commuter system.
And with all those bicyclists and pedestrians, Wilcoxon says those possibilities could include economic development on land surrounding the canals. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Appropriations committees in the Arizona House and Senate today approved the package of three bills that would settle the five-year-old lawsuit over inflation funding for schools. The funding package has strong backing on the GOP side of the aisle. One of those supporters is Representative Paul Boyer of Phoenix. And Paul, why do you think this is a good idea?
Because this puts $3.5 billion into K-12 education over 10 years. If we had to adhere to the court order today, which we don't, but if we did, it'd be $3.8 billion. So it's $300 million off of what the court originally decided the legislature had to pay. It puts significant dollars into the classroom.
Paul, what about when it gets to the classroom? There have been some who've said if, in fact, this gets through the legislature and it will be a special election coming up, but not until next spring. Do you think that is soon enough?
There is a direct appropriation, however, so there is statutory law that we intend on passing that injects $50 million immediately. But you're right, the state land trust proposal, the election is slated for May 17th of 2016, and of course that wouldn't get into the classroom until after probably the next fiscal year for schools.
Do you feel like we are behind at this point and an extra 6 to 8 to 9 months will make a difference, or is the right plan worth waiting for?
We are behind at this point, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't plan for the future. So we know that we have a significant amount of teachers that are eligible for retirement over the next 4 years. And so I'm just grateful the governor has had the foresight to say, look, we need to get money over 10 years, of course, but significant dollars into the classroom. And whether or not that is immediate or whether or not that will happen in 6 to 9 months, I'll take the money in 6 to 9 months if that's the case.
There's a feeling that this deal makes sense to most people, but there are also some concern that if we have an economic downturn, which is always a possibility, the economy is cyclical, that K-12 education may not be as high a priority as people think it needs to be right now. Are you concerned about any of the so-called triggers?
I'm not, and that actually, because we have so many funding priorities, including the Department of Child Safety, developmental disabilities, universities, community colleges, and so many other funding priorities in a down economy, this just gives us the flexibility to fund public safety and health and education.
So you're not concerned about it losing priority, you just think this is practical?
It is practical. I'm always concerned about education funding, but if we say we do have significantly less growth as a state overall, we do have to be able to afford all of the functions of government.
Does there still have to be a long-term plan for Arizona, regardless of whether this plan makes sense now?
There does, and I think primarily through capital funding. I think that there are some buildings in public school buildings in Arizona that are decrepit, that are falling apart. HVAC units, as you know, they're overly used here, especially in the Valley. And so there does need to be a long-term strategy moving forward. And I think part of that strategy does involve the Classrooms First Initiative. And what I like to call not just classrooms funding, but student funding. Whatever it takes to educate the student, whether it's not captured in traditional classroom spending dollars. So for example, psychologists, reading specialists, teachers' aides, those typically aren't captured in classroom spending, but they're all necessary and critical to the education of the particular student.
Republican State Representative Paul Boyer.
For more on what's been going on at the Capitol today, we now talk to Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. And Howie, as we said earlier, the appropriations committees in both chambers have passed the package of three bills. Where do we stand now in the process?
Well, they both go to the respective floors, excuse me there, and the issue becomes that this is being given to lawmakers as a take-it-or-leave-it proposition. They're basically being told, look, this was negotiated. The School Boards Association, which sued, is a part of it. They're happy with it. The governor's office is happy with it. The Republican legislative leadership is happy with it. And that's caused some heartburn among folks, mainly the Democrats, who say, wait, there's cash there. But there's also some concern among some of the Republicans. Current Treasurer Jeff DeWitt and former Treasurer Dean Martin testified this morning and said, look, you cannot simply triple the amount of money you're taking out of the trust and say you're going to do that without potentially endangering the trust. So it'll be fascinating to see as we go into floor debate later this afternoon and early into the evening what amendments there are and whether any of them do manage to get on the bill.
Yeah, is there a chance that after all of the negotiations for months and months, that some amendment that could be offered could potentially derail the whole thing?
Well, it depends on how technical the amendment is. I mean, obviously, the school board folks are down there, and along with their lawyers and accountants and everyone else. If it's a minor change, it might delay things a bit. But if you're going to say, well, we're not going to take as much money out of the trust because we're concerned about that, now you've blown the whole thing apart. Because you remember, out of that $3.5 billion over the next decade, $2.2 billion of that comes out of the trust. Now, Jeff DeWitt has some numbers that say, look, you can get $2.2 billion over the next 10 years, but then over the following 40 years, you'll actually reduce state aid to schools. Because this is, remember, this is school money set aside for schools, that you'll reduce the amount of money the schools will get by perhaps $6 or $7 billion. And if you extrapolate that over the next 90 years, now you're into $70-plus billion that schools won't get because you've reduced the amount of money in the trust now. And that becomes the real heartburn, I think, for a lot of folks.
You've mentioned that a lot of the heartburn is on the part of Democrats. Have we heard concerns from Republicans to the point where they might not vote for it?
Well, that's sort of a split question. Have we heard concerns from Republicans? You bet. Don Shuter, who chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee, after listening to former Treasurer Dean Martin, said he'd like to talk with him. Rusty Bowers in the House said he's expressing concerns. But at this point, the only Republican who's voted against it, remember, not everyone has weighed in, was State Senator Kelly Ward, who said she would not support the trust land proposal. I don't know that she's going to end up getting a lot more Republicans joining her. I think a lot of folks say, look, let's just move this on. You know, as Paul Boyer said, you know, something needs to be done. The question is this the best way to do this? And, you know, is there another alternative? And what also does it mean? Now, there's another, you know, caveat to all this. All this is subject to voter approval in May. And some folks are already warning lawmakers that, look, if you're going to use trust land and not use the money we've got, and then come back in January and use that money for tax cuts for corporations, why should we approve this? And so there are folks who could be watching to see what lawmakers do with the money that Paul Boyer says provides them, as he says, the flexibility for public safety and health, doesn't provide them the flexibility to give corporate tax cuts.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
I'm glad to be here.
The Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Commission is expected to vote tomorrow on a new rule that aims to shine some light on so-called dark money. Tom Collins is the commission's executive director. And Tom, what would this new rule do?
Well, the rule really just establishes the process for determining folks who are going to have to file certain campaign finance reports in the state. One of the things that both the public and, frankly, those who make expenditures in political campaigns have really struggled with over the course of the last several years in Arizona is what are the rules of the road? This rule that the commission has been examining simply identifies what the rules of the road should be and who should file campaign finance reports and who doesn't need to file campaign finance reports, including reports that relate to contributor information.
So under this rule, who would be required to file reports that isn't required to do so now?
Well, that's a really good question. And one of the problems that, as a policy matter, has been there has been a divide among the various folks who make expenditures about what dollars should count toward making you a political committee and obligated to file full disclosure. For example, in the 2014 election, some folks claimed that if you spend money on a ballot measure, that wouldn't count towards whether or not you were a political committee. Only candidate spending would count. Well, this rule clarifies that in Arizona, ballot measures and candidate spending all count as dollars that are political that ought to be accounted for in determining whether or not you should file as a political committee. Within that, you need to be spending the majority of your expenditures in a given election cycle on election activity, be it ballot measure or candidate-related activities, in order to have to file as a political committee.
Now, there's still the question, especially from the Secretary of State's office, as to whether or not the commission even has the right to be doing this at all. Is this something that commissioners are concerned about?
I think the commissioners are, quite convinced that the commission has authority in the area of independent expenditures. The commission has spent a lot of time examining how it should apply that authority, and that's been a robust discussion that's occurred in open meetings for the public to partake in. I will say, though, that I think at this point the commission's authority in this area has been vindicated by both the Arizona Supreme Court and more recently the Maricopa County Superior Court.
Do you think that if this rule passes, it'll be the last word on this issue, or do you expect there to be more discussion?
Well, I think the commissioners themselves today recognize that, you know, there will be a legislative session forthcoming. There may be ballot measure activity in this area forthcoming. So for anyone to say that this rule is a reason why, you know, there ought to be war declared on the Clean Elections Commission or that the world is going to end, that's really not realistic. That's really, really a kind of a rhetoric that is both counterproductive and false. The reality is that the commission has an obligation to try to make sure that the rules of the road are clear both for those who spend money in elections in Arizona, as is their First Amendment right, and for the public to be able to understand how that money will be tracked. The commission will work with all stakeholders and will continue to on an ongoing basis, but the commission has also said, look, if it votes for this rule, these are the right rules to start from for any kind of discussion. And we think it's important, and the commissioners think it's important, to really give some rules of the road. Because right now, absent the commission's action, until the legislature does or does not do something, there is no other rule in place. And so I think that the legislature can take action, the voters can take action themselves. But in the meantime, the commission, I think, believes if they vote for this, that it has an obligation to provide clear rules of the road for both spenders and voters.
Tom Collins is the executive director of the Citizens Clean Elections Commission. The commission expected to vote on that final rule tomorrow afternoon. Tom, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, why major corporations are coming to the Valley to recruit unemployed young people.
This is a critical issue. Because for every one of those young people who gets into a job and into the workplace, they're going to contribute $1 million to the economy over the course of their career.
Looking for a job just ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. With Mark, I'm Steve. We should have partly cloudy skies through the rest of this afternoon around the valley, and there's a 40% chance for some more rain. We may top out in the lower 80s. And then for tonight, partly cloudy again with a chance for rain and lows in the lower 60s. Should be partly sunny with a chance of morning rain and a high in the upper 70s. We did have a severe thunderstorm warning in effect for the valley, but that was allowed to expire. Looks like that threat has lessened quite a bit. Currently, we have partly cloudy skies and 81 degrees at KJZZ. Meanwhile, in valley traffic, couple of accidents, one on the 51 southbound at Indian School, that's blocking the shoulder. Also, a collision in the median at I-10 at 7th Street, and it's affecting both east and westbound traffic. It's 219.
KJZZ is supported by the Arizona State Fair, now through November 8th. A state fair ticket is admission to Hanson with Nelson on Friday, November 6th. Hanson with Nelson reserve ticket info at azstatefair.com.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. A swirl of apparent change in China. Naval cat and mouse games in the South China Sea all week long between the U.S. Navy and China, and the Chinese Communist Party announced the end of its one-child policy.
The party says Chinese couples will now be allowed to have up to two children. That's any number from zero to two, says the party. Joining us is Simon Den, your China bureau chief for the Washington Post. Simon, is this the end of an era in China?
Absolutely. I mean, this is perhaps the greatest, the biggest population control experiment in human history. And it's not completely over. As you say, Chinese couples will still have to have two children as a maximum, no more than that. But it is the end of the one-child policy, a hugely controversial and very unpopular policy here.
Morally a failure, politically a failure, or in population terms, a failure?
Probably all three of those things. I mean, certainly morally a failure. There were brutal sterilizations and abortions. There were bribes paid to skirt the rules. The idea that officials could have control over women's bodies was morally repugnant to many people. But economically a failure too, because, you know, here we have a China where the population is aging very rapidly. The labor force is shrinking, and one-child policy has made that worse. So China's facing some real economic headwinds because of the demographics. Demographers have been calling for at least 10 years for this policy to be abandoned. The party has finally recognized that the policy needed to be abandoned, but just to restate, it hasn't completely abandoned it. It can't admit that it made a mistake, so it's still got some policy in place, a two-child policy now instead of a one-child policy.
Now, what would you say is the political implication of this cat-and-mouse game in the South China Sea? Is this nationalism actually built up as islands constructed in the South China Sea that the United States is now trying to challenge? And is it mostly for domestic consumption, or is this brewing into a superpower incident of some kind?
A bit of both, frankly. I mean, Xi Jinping is doing what he's doing because he's bolstering his domestic credentials as a nationalist, because he thinks that China genuinely ought to be more assertive on the world stage, and because he thinks that it's been walked over too long. So he wants to champion China's rights in many fields, and territorial field is one of those fields. So it is a lot to do with domestic consumption and domestic politics. But that domestic politics is also quite hard to handle, because what you saw when the U.S. sailed through the waters close to one of the islands this week was a lot of people in China going, well, why isn't China doing more to stand up to it? So once you start toying with nationalism, it's quite difficult to know, you know, where to draw the line. In response to the second part, yes, there is a real rivalry developing between the U.S. and China. The South China Sea is one of the main crucibles of that rivalry. It's going to have to be carefully managed. Neither side wants a confrontation. Neither side wants military escalation. But both sides are going to have to manage this rivalry quite carefully.
Is that to say that China has no option but to take out a destroyer to go to the next step? Could it box in a ship for a while? Could it actually board and stop a ship? I mean, it seems like there are very few options other than saying, get out of here.
It's very much to be seen, I think, how often the U.S. does this. whether the ships loiter, whether China starts to put a little bit more pressure. I don't think we're going to see ramming, but we could see close approaches. We could see brinkmanship. And when you get that kind of thing happening, there is, of course, the risk of accidents. There is, of course, the risk of actual contact between the ships.
China bureau chief of the Washington Post on the end of the one-child policy in China and the beginning of some brinkmanship between the U.S. and China in the South China Sea. Simon, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Staying with international news, for the past 2 months, the German carmaker Volkswagen has been under fire after admitting to cheating emissions tests by using, quote, defeat device software on its diesel engines. The scandal has resulted in recalls of millions of cars worldwide and corporate management shakeups. But how have the problems at Volkswagen affected the company's hometown of Wolfsburg?
For many, Wolfsburg is Volkswagen. More than half of its inhabitants work for the company. It's Germany's prosperous answer to America's car capital, Detroit. But as the BBC's Emma Jane Kirby reports, the events at Volkswagen have taken a heavy toll on the town.
It's a filthy and depressing morning as I pull into Wolfsburg station. But glinting in whatever light the dreary sky can spare, I can see the giant Volkswagen tower piercing through the black clouds proudly as the rain batters its famous emblem. The company's reputation has been taking more than a few knocks over the recent emission scandal. But I've come here to find out whether the townsfolk, 60% of whom work for Volkswagen, feel shaken up by the events.
Our bus has just pulled up, and it's got VW Werk on it. It's a commuter bus taking everybody to the VW site, so I'm going to jump on board, see what people are thinking.
May I ask you a question? I work for the BBC.
Yes.
I'm asking people about Volkswagen.
Sorry, I can give you an answer.
Do you feel hurt?
Sorry, I'm not interested.
I don't know how I feel about it.
It's them that security approaches us and asks us to leave the premises.
So they all stick very close together and are very proud of their company.
Dirk Grosseleger, the former head of communications at Volkswagen between 2002 and 2007, tells me not to be surprised that the town is fiercely loyal to the hand that feeds it.
It definitely is a very strong culture that Volkswagen has. Being headquartered in Wolfsburg and not in a major city, most people work there in third, fourth generation. So, you know, if it comes to external critics, then everybody sticks together and doesn't allow any criticism on the company, really. It's one united group of people.
Do you think that's been a fault for the company? It's been its own undoing.
Now, you could certainly question, if you have such a strong culture, if it allows enough opinions and influences to enter from the outside, which is very often very positive for a culture, because otherwise you are only sitting among your own people and maybe lacking some new ideas or influence from outside.
In the local bakery, retired couple Katharina and Martin, who worked for Volkswagen for over 40 years, are grumbling over their coffee that Volkswagen's badge of honor and Germany's national pride have been tarnished. Martin worries that his pension might be affected and reminds us just how much this town relies on Volkswagen for its wealth. It's always been this way in Wolfsburg, he tells me. We've been through many ups and downs, but we always warn that when Volkswagen gets a cough, all the other companies here catch a lung infection. At Wolfsburg's acclaimed science museum, local schoolchildren are enjoying a day out. Volkswagen funds dozens of sporting and cultural projects in the town, but with fears that profits may be severely dented, at least in the short term, the city council has now ordered a spending and recruitment freeze. Michael Wilkins from the Chamber of Commerce sent us this statement.
Caution is the highest commandment for every salesman. And because of this, the town hall's measures are understandable. But the public finances are in excellent health, and that's why we can all wait for further developments without panicking.
At the Science Museum, the school children are learning the principles of angular momentum. And as class action lawsuits pile up against Volkswagen, the townsfolk of Würzburg may find their lives spinning rather faster and more irregularly than they'd like.
That's the BBC's Emma Jane Kirby in Germany.
Arizona lost one of its last cowboy legislators yesterday. Jack Brown, a Democrat from St. John's, passed away. He was 86 years old. Brown was first elected to the House in 1963 and served in both the House and Senate on and off until his retirement in 2010, more than 40 years in office overall. As his last legislative session wrapped up, I sat down with Brown in his office at the Capitol and asked him what it was like when he first started.
Well, I didn't know very much about it. I'd never been to the Capitol building until I was elected and came down here to be sworn in, so I was pretty green. I learned a lot, and I was surprised at how much there was to do on the state level.
During his time in the legislature, Brown served in leadership both in the House and Senate. When not at the Capitol, he worked on his family's ranch and, as he said, dabbled in real estate. Over his decades in office, he witnessed countless changes, but he lamented one of them.
We used to work together with the Republicans and Democrats without fighting and fussing and blaming the other side all the time. And that's what one thing that's changed is we've gelled into two sides that hardly want to even talk to each other, let alone work together.
When people look back at Jack Brown's legacy at the Capitol, what would you like for them to think of?
You know, one thought comes to mind is that they would say old Jack Brown thought that he was pretty important, but not all that great importance, and that Jack Brown had the philosophy to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I've always thought that I'd kind of want to treat you about like I expect you to, and hope you would treat me.
Former state lawmaker Jack Brown in 2010. Brown passed away yesterday at the age of 86.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
On your mark, get set, shoot 'em.
My name is Billy McWilliams. We're at the Arizona State Fair. We've been playing a lot of games, having fun. I want to win prizes for our kids.
How about carrying it around?
Well, I won a big stuffed teddy bear. That was playing a basketball game. And the bear's got a little bear. Is it cute? And then I want a little mini guy popping the balloons.
We need two more. Yay!
Our littlest one is two. He loves balloons. He'd rather have a balloon than a stuffed animal.
Race to the top, top to the top, and it's gonna be lucky winner number 13.
That's Billy McWilliams playing some games at the Arizona State Fair. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to send us a Cupid doll, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Still to come, a new president takes on the federal government.
This is a fight that's not going to be over today, tomorrow, next month. We're going to be fighting this for years to come.
We meet the leader of the Navajo Nation ahead. It's the show.
Good Thursday afternoon. It is the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic, a collision on the 51 southbound at Indian School. There's also an accident, I-10 at 7th Street, which is still affecting both east and westbound traffic. As you can see, it's cloudy outside. We expect those clouds to stay with us at least through the rest of this afternoon into the evening. We have a 40% chance for some daytime rain. And then for tonight, that becomes a 30% chance with lows in the lower to mid-60s. For tomorrow, a chance for rain in the morning and then afternoon clearing with highs in the upper 70s and then sunny skies by Saturday with a high of 80 degrees. Currently, relative humidity is at 32%. Cloudy skies, 81 degrees at 91.5 at 233.
KJZZ is supported by the Fruitkin Law Firm, reminding you to celebrate your loved ones in connection with Estate Planning Week. More information can be found on the web at estateplanningweek.com.
Tomorrow morning, the 100K Opportunity Initiative holds its second opportunity job fair. This one will be in Phoenix at the Convention Center. It's targeting young people who are between 16 and 24 years old and are either unemployed or aren't on a focused career or school track. In a few minutes, we'll hear from one Young Valley woman who will be attending the fair. First, though, we're joined by Blair Taylor. He's Chief Community Officer for Starbucks and also oversees the 100K Opportunity Initiative. Blair, why can these young people rely on corporate America to be open-minded and creative about their talent and their future?
The analogy I often use is the opportunity youth or disengaged youth population in America today is in many ways very similar to where the veteran population was 25 years ago. And if you think back 25 years ago, veterans' relationships with corporate America was not very strong. In fact, corporate America largely thought veterans didn't have the skill set to take on corporate jobs. Everybody was labeled with PTSD. And as we fast forwarded, we've realized 25 years later, actually, most veterans are able to work, ready to work, and have tremendous skills to provide to corporate America. The opportunity youth population is as differentiated as that veterans population. Yes, there are opportunity youth on one side of the spectrum who need significant intervention. That's why we have a coalition of nonprofits that we'll be working with for those who need additional support skills or need more significant levels of intervention. But there's also a cohort, just as with veterans, who are very close to work ready, if not work ready today.
What if someone were to say to you, I'm pretty sharp, I don't really want to start at the entry level?
Well, let me tell you something. You know, somebody comes to work for a company like Starbucks, for example. They work for Starbucks, let's call it, for 4 years. They can get a degree through Arizona State University and our college achievement plan. They can get a degree tuition-free in any discipline from Arizona State University, working for only 20 hours a week. That's part-time as a barista at Starbucks. They can get their degree in engineering. They can go on, and 4 years later, they could be a store manager, managing a store, which is more than a $1 million operation with 25 employees. That person is a fantastic candidate for the next level of jobs in America.
How important a point in time is this? Are we on the cusp of saying something where an effort like this is vital to make sure that these so-called disengaged young people grab on to the right path?
This is why I say this is maybe the most important issue of our time. First of all, if you look at almost 6 million young people across the U.S., if you extrapolate that and look at it globally, it's north of 300 million young people, 16 to 24, around the world, who are not at work and not in school. And the reason why we say not at work and not in school is those are young people who need to be either at work or in school at that age. They are in a highly productive period of their life. This is a critical issue because for every one of those young people who gets into a job and into the workplace, they're going to contribute $1 million to the economy over the course of their career. They also become better citizens. They become more involved in society generally. And candidly, for corporate America and for America in general, this is not a nice to do. This is a workforce that, as the labor pool has tightened post the Great Recession, companies need to find new sources of talent. This is an untapped source of talent for America. And make no mistake about it, this is not charity. We're not looking at this through the charity prism. We're finding exceptional talent. It's just a talent that we have not tapped from corporate America to date, and now we are intent upon trying to figure that out.
Blair Taylor of Starbucks. He's overseeing the 100K Opportunity Initiative. Valley resident Amelia Hernandez is 20 years old. She's a full-time student at Glendale Community College and is taking classes at Phoenix College, but she'll be going to the Opportunity Fair because she doesn't have a job. Amelia, what is your classwork focused on?
As of right now, I'm aiming towards my associate's degree in science with a major in biology. I do plan to become a doctor, specifically pediatrician. As of right now, I'm trying to get a job in order to pay, you know, and sustain my life, pretty much.
Have you been looking for a part-time job? Is there something specific? Do you want to be in a certain track as far as that goes? Do you just want something to make a little money? And does it have to fit into a certain schedule based on your class hours?
It does indeed have to fit in a certain schedule that I have with my school. So any job right now that it's flexible, because, you know, most jobs are pretty strict with hours. So any job that's flexible with those hours and can work around my school schedule would be great.
What have you looked at so far? Who are the types of people you've talked to as far as type of jobs?
Right. So far I've looked into part-time jobs. I'm not really looking into full-time jobs just because of my school schedule. I have looked into my current gym that I'm participating in. I've also looked into front desk operating jobs because they seem to be a little bit more flexible with hours.
So later this week, there's going to be a big job fair with at least 20 employers and 20 pretty major employers. Will you be taking part in that, and why do you think that's important?
Yes, I'll be taking part of that. I'll be trying to connect with as many people as possible. I think that's important in order for me to get a job, and also I'll be taking the resources that I get at the job fair back to my respective group.
When you interview for a job, it's not just about the interviewer. It's about you getting a good feel for them. Are there certain kinds of questions, even generally, that you'd want to ask an employer?
I think it's just asking them how they can help you and if they can help you, if they're willing to help you with your schooling and stuff like that. And also, I think it's important to really dig deep and find what the purpose of the company is. If they're really about their employees and about their customers, then I think that's key to ask an employer.
20-year-old Amelia Hernandez talking about tomorrow's 100K Opportunity Initiative Fair in Phoenix.
A group of Peoria residents will be reviewing the city's charter and making recommendations for possible changes to the city council. The panel should start its work in a couple of months and will make its suggestions around May. The city council will decide which of those to refer to voters for next year's November election. Peoria Mayor Kathy Carlett campaigned on the idea of setting up a citizen committee.
Our city charter is the most important document that we have in our city. It governs all of our policies, it governs our form of government, our districts, and it can only be changed through a vote of the citizens. However, our city charter has been in effect for quite a long time. It was adopted in 1983, and it has not had a comprehensive citizens review since 1992. During that period of time, though, some amendments have gone to the ballot, but in addition to that, there has been a lot of changes in state legislation. There has been a lot of general changes to our culture, our way of life, and, you know, since the 80s, you know, our charter needs to keep up with those kinds of things. So it's time for us to take a really good long look at it. The reason that I'm bringing it forward right now is because I don't want it to be to take a look at it internally or, you know, through our regular forms that we might do, which would be staff, and then bring it to council. I really want this document to be something living and breathing that our citizens have created and that our citizens still stand by. Yes, this is how we want our government to function. So I want it to be a transparent document, and I want it to be accountable to the citizens of Peoria.
How will you find the folks who will be looking at this?
Well, we're going to pick them out from all around the city. So we will have citizens from every district. We're divided into six districts in our city. And so we will have the council members talk to and appoint citizens from their district. And then I will appoint a couple people also at large.
Do you have any expectation of what they might find or what they might recommend?
You know, at this point, I honestly don't know. I can't give you any clear and specific examples of what they might find, but I am sure that there will need to be updates.
Is there anything that you're hoping that they come up with or areas that you think are sort of ripe for a change?
Actually, there is nothing in the city charter that I am specifically looking to change, but there is one thing that I would like to add as an addition, and that is future review process. So right now, if some member of the council wanted to just, you know, get a majority of the council members and to say yes and throw something on the ballot, it's there. And that's how you know, pieces of this very carefully put together puzzle can become askew, and then they don't match anymore. And through the years, those kinds of things have happened here and there. There needs to be a review process that is put in the charter that includes review by a citizens committee.
Is there any part of you that's concerned that, like, the panel might come up with, hey, we should, like, annex Glendale, or we should make every Friday a paid holiday in the city? Like, something that is sort of so far off that maybe residents would like it, but would really be a problem for the city?
Well, I'm really not that concerned about something totally outlandish or far-fetched, because, you know, we will have our city attorney there. We will have, I believe, a group of very intelligent citizens, as we have in the city of Peoria, who will be sitting there knowing that they are going to make a recommendation that is going to go into a manual that is going to run our city.
Peoria Mayor Kathy Carlett. Mayor Carlett, thank you so much.
Thank you for calling.
There's a new development that's intended to help Arizonans get more information on literacy and what results schools and communities are getting. The system is called MapLit and has been launched by Read On Arizona. The public data include reading assessment scores, library locations, and attendance rates, among other things. Terry Clark is Arizona's literacy director.
This is sort of what we're calling a one-stop resource of a number of different data sets that all impact early literacy outcomes for kids through the end of third grade. So the kind of data that's involved is everything from education data you would expect on third grade reading outcomes. Also, there is health data, there's family engagement data, and there's also, for the first time, preschool and early childhood and childcare sites, locations, and some information there that we've never had access to before, all in one place.
Now, is this something that parents can figure out on their own? Does this take a more educated hand, someone who's more familiar with this, or is this pretty accessible?
Well, we'd like to think that this is pretty accessible, and the reason that we used a mapping tool to visualize the data is so that it was, as I like to say, digestible for users. It's easy to find. It's easy to visualize what you're looking at. You know, you don't have to struggle to find what you're looking for. You just kind of have to click on a few buttons and get to the area on the map that you're interested in and find the data sets that you're looking for.
So, Terry, let's say we have the data in front of us. One thing that's always key with data is knowing how to use it and knowing how to change things if change is needed. How did these numbers, in fact, make it clear to people where literacy is in Arizona and, in fact, whether it needs to be improved and how we do improve it?
The most important thing you just hit on is that it is important. Data is only as good as we use it to inform our future actions and sort of movement going forward. So what we're really hoping is that schools or community partners, nonprofits, principals, and parents and teachers will use this data, look at it, and then help it to inform what their next steps are. For example, if they discover in the data that they have a high chronic absence rate at their school or site, then there would be strategies involved in helping to bring awareness to that, to helping to decrease that percentage to a more manageable level, and to really get at that root cause. So that's what we're really hoping, is that it's just the start of how to really think forward and use data to drive your decisions.
Could this lead to more attention from public policy officials? And is this the sort of information that needs to sort of be put under their nose on maybe a regular basis? Like, here's a report based on what MapLit had in the last quarter or the next quarter, that sort of thing.
I think it's absolutely a tool that can be used by key influencers and key stakeholders to help inform them again of sort of what direction to take going forward. I think the most important thing is it's a rich tool, and it can help guide communities on what strategies are needed and then help them to identify the resources needed to be able to fill that gap in service. But I think the other important part is that it's going to require all the partners to sort of up their game and how they interpret and analyze data. And we won't, from now on, just be able to quote one data source, but we'll have a pipeline of data that can help make the case.
Terry Clark, Arizona's literacy director, telling us about MapLit.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark. He's Steve. It's partly cloudy, 80 degrees at KJZZ at 250.
KJZZ is supported by the Chris Williamson 40th anniversary celebration of the album The Changer and the Changed at Mesa Arts Center Thursday, November 5th. Tickets for Chris Williamson and friends at mesaartscenter.com.
The Navajo president entered office in the wake of a major political drama. At its center was the issue of language. The Navajo people are grappling with a culture rooted in its traditions and history, but they're also heavily influenced by a modern Western world, and its leader is attempting to bridge that gap. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales has this profile of Navajo President Russell Begay.
Teresa Hatathli and many other Navajos don't trust politicians.
They talk about honesty, and then the perception is something else. And then they talk about respect. A lot of that has to be earned.
Hatathli says for Navajos, this idea of leadership has evolved from a spiritual guide to policymaker. Navajo President Russell Begay is trying to be both. His political experience is limited. He served one term as a council delegate. He spent most of his career as a Baptist minister. You can hear the preacher in him in his inaugural address.
When you look back, you never dreamed that you would be the president of the great Navajo Nation. It's a gift first from the people. It's also a gift from Almighty God.
Begay was given the gift of a second chance after a candidate was disqualified from the presidential race for refusing to prove his Navajo language skills. Begay has since made language resurgence his mission.
You will be left behind, we were told, if we spoke our language. As a result, our people did not teach their children the language. Today, we will not believe that anymore. Our language has great value. It is who we are as Navajo people. So let's not ever be ashamed of speaking Navajo again.
Not everyone values the language as much as Begay. Soon after he was inaugurated, the issue was put to a vote. Should the next president and vice president speak Navajo fluently? The people decided that the requirement was essentially unnecessary. Begay blames low voter turnout. 21% of the tribe voted on the issue.
So I think people just took for granted, you know, who's going to vote against speaking Navajo, our leader speaking Navajo? And afterwards, people saying, if I knew this was going to happen, I would have gone and voted and protected the language.
The vote was a blow to the president, but then something happened, a disaster to several Navajo communities, a boon to Begay's political career. In August, the Environmental Protection Agency was investigating an old mine in Colorado when the agency accidentally released 3 million gallons of toxic waste into the Animas and San Juan Rivers. Initially, the EPA downplayed the incident and provided little information to the Navajo, whose farmers depend on the water for their crops and livestock. So President Begay traveled to the source of the spill and posted pictures and videos of it on Facebook.
The person was working the backhoe. He just rushed out here, and the water burst through here, and it just went straight down the mountain down here that you saw pictures of.
Begay continues to keep an eye on the spill and the federal government's response. In September, he testified before the Senate Indian Affairs Committee.
The U.S. EPA has abandoned us. The water tanks are being pulled out. Feed for our livestock has stopped.
Begay went from figurehead to tech-savvy watchdog overnight.
They're just telling us, you know, you put enough water with these chemicals, and then it becomes safe to drink.
Begay says he wants the EPA to keep testing the water and clean up its mess. Many Navajo people, young and old, have united behind the president against the federal government.
So this is a fight that's not going to be over today, tomorrow, next month. We're gonna be fighting this for years to come.
Begay tweets and posts updates on Facebook about his efforts to address the many problems facing the Navajo Nation. Issues like unemployment, suicide, and protecting natural resources. And thanks to social media, everyone can keep tabs on the president and hold him accountable. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
Uh-huh.
As the daily newspaper has gotten thinner, our comic strip choices have also dwindled. Sure, you can still find Garfield and Family Circus and even some Peanuts classics, but if you can't get enough of the comics, you've got to go online. Stuart Reese is a San Diego-based cartoonist who also represents other cartoonists as an attorney. And Stuart, as the technology changes, do comic strips still have that cultural following they used to have?
Well, I think comic strips are probably more relevant than they ever used to be. They're still there in the newspaper, and so anybody in the habit of reading newspapers can still have their steady diet of comics just like they always have. But now comics have evolved into being available sort of in all the nooks and crannies of the internet, whether you're at a newspaper website or a portal or on subject-specific pages. The comic strips are everywhere. Every single comic strip that was ever in the newspaper is now available online through the syndicates or the syndicates' various partners. So it's actually easier to find cartoons than it ever used to be.
Is there more of a passion for the older strips that people read for 20 years as opposed to some of the newer ones?
I think you have a lot of people who are very comfortable with the comics that they've read for 5, 10, 20, even 50 years. But if you talk to the nation's youth, the gigantic number of teen and even 20 and 30-year-olds who are playing video games every single day, and they go to video game websites, there are some extremely popular daily comics that have become integrated into these gamers' life just as much as any comic strip in the newspaper ever was for, you know, my father or, you know, given my age, even me.
With the move to online, does this create a whole new category of, I'm going to say dreamers, not in a pejorative way, but folks who think that, you know, if they happen to hit upon the right niche, maybe they can make a sort of semi-career out of this at least? Is there that feeling that they're no longer feeling like a syndicate or a group of newspapers is going to sort of reject them as a whole? They can try their own way.
Yes, absolutely. There have always been people who wanted to become newspaper cartoonists. I mean, the numbers that I used to hear in the 1990s is that typically sort of 6,000 or so people would send in their portfolios to the half dozen or so newspaper syndicates, and those newspaper syndicates would typically launch between 12 and 15 total cartoons industry-wide. So, I mean, the chance of getting picked up by a newspaper syndicate and then being successfully launched in a newspaper environment and getting enough clients to survive, you know, it was always an extremely difficult road. Nowadays, those 6,000 people who are submitting, if they don't like the no that they got from the newspaper syndicate, they can just put their stuff online and let the public decide, not some editor sitting at a desk. And you know, that's a little bit liberating and exciting for the average artist.
As people use newspapers differently now and fewer people read the hard copy, does the Sunday newspaper still hold up in the sense, is do people still really want to get those color strips on a Sunday? Does that still draw more people?
I don't want to paint too rosy a picture on it. I mean, certainly newspaper comics are under pressure. I mean, there's just no denying that. But Sunday comics appeal to people who have read Sunday comics their whole life. And they also are probably the best gateway for younger audiences because people my kids' age, I mean, they're accustomed to their cartoons being in color, and Sunday comics look and feel like the Nickelodeon shows and other shows that they watch. So the world has, you know, a shortened attention span. And back in the 1980s, I think it was, there was a study that said the Americans had an average of a 7-second attention span, and I described the continuing relevance of newspaper comics by saying that in a world of 7-second attention spans, a newspaper comic is a 4-second read.
Stuart Reese is a San Diego-based attorney and cartoonist. We've been talking about the present and future of comic strips. Stuart, thank you for the time.
Well, thank you very much.
Make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 for the show. Efforts to make sure hikers at the Grand Canyon have drinking water and we'll meet the pumpkin carver to the stars. Hopefully he's not carving pumpkins of either Steve or me. That's tomorrow afternoon at the show, on KJZZ.
And if you're looking for some stuff to do on a Thursday night and you're a football fan, why not head out to Sun Devil Stadium as ASU hosts the University of Oregon. That gets underway at 7:30.
You can find out what Jane says tonight. Jane's Addiction playing Veterans Memorial Coliseum on the state fairgrounds tonight.
And at the Crescent Ballroom tonight at 8, it's Green Sky, Bluegrass.
The show is produced by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout, Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer, news director Al Macias, executive producer John Hoban. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. It's KJZZ at 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, specialists who develop innovative transplant solutions for patients from around the world, right here in Phoenix. More about transplant programs at mayoclinic.org.